Glucagon-like peptide 1 or GLP-1 receptor agonists have been the focus of a great deal of pharmaceutical investment and development in recent years. Although there are clear benefits of constraining the growth of the obesity epidemic, some concerning signals have emerged with the use of these drugs, including in people without approved indications. I'm Stephen Morrissey, managing editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm talking with Amanda Banks, a consultant and a physician at the Corporal Michael J. Crescens VA Medical Center in Philadelphia. Dr. Banks has written a perspective article about GLP-1 receptor agonists and the risks of eating disorders. Dr. Banks, to start, approximately how many people in the United States are taking GLP-1 receptor agonists?
In the U.S., approximately 1 in 8 adults have reported taking a GLP-1 agonist. So that translates into tens of millions of people in the U.S. alone who are on these drugs.
You say in your article that people increasingly use these medications to achieve and to maintain slimness in the absence of diabetes or obesity, for example. So how common is that type of use, and where do people without approved indications obtain these drugs?
There's some very good data around this question, although we're starting to just now get our hands around the overuse and misuse of GLP-1 agonists. With respect to prescriptions that have been reported to prescribing sources, we know that prescriptions have been written for people without diabetes, obesity, or overweight with cardiovascular risk factors. That number increased from 4.5% of prescriptions written in 2018 to about 17% in 2023. So we can assume that that number is higher now, and also that it's higher in general because these are numbers that are derived from data from prescribing databases. Very often, it's possible for people who are interested in driving thinness to acquire these medications from compounding pharmacies, for example, that aren't subject to the same reporting requirements.
What's known about the effects of GLP-1 receptor agonists in people who have or at risk for various eating disorders?
I think it's worth probably just maybe spending a minute thinking about why this might be an issue, and I think that might frame the conversation quite well around what the risks might be and what's known about those risks. Certainly, there are strong societal cultural elements at play here that magnify the value of thinness and equate it to personal value. And that's part of our diet culture that we've been living with in this country and, in fact, globally for as many years as many of us have been alive. And so that drives a desire for thinness that can reinforce weight loss as a virtue and sort of can ignore the risk factors that accompany rapid weight loss, regardless of the size of one's body. But there's also an interesting biological connection between the GLP-1s and, in particular, restrictive eating disorders, in that anorexia nervosa has been understood commonly as a decision or as a psychiatric illness purely or as a manifestation of expert dieting. But in fact, anorexia nervosa is not a choice. It is a complex medical illness like obesity that has psychiatric elements, genetic underpinnings, and is influenced by the environment. And indeed, it is primarily a metabolic disorder. And anorexia nervosa exists on a metabolic spectrum with obesity at one side and anorexia nervosa on the other. And within that context, it's important to understand that obesity and anorexia share pathways in the brain that influence what we eat, when we eat, and how much we eat, and controls the calories that we burn, that they work in opposite directions. So GLP-1 agonists work through these same pathways. So there's a biological reason why GLP-1 agonists can put at risk someone who has a history of restrictive eating disorders or who has a propensity or biological predisposition to those eating disorders because it shuts off hunger signals and simultaneously increases satiety signals with exposures that exceed the physiologic exposures that we experience with eating.
You say in your article that clinicians may not recognize complications related to disordered eating at all, but especially in people with a normal or a high body mass index. So why are symptoms of eating disorders so often overlooked in these patients?
There's several reasons for it. I think primarily the education for clinicians around eating disorders is insufficient, not just in the US, but globally. There have been studies that have shown that in totality in US medical training programs, physicians receive less than 2 hours of medical training about eating disorders in 4 years. And so we all sort of come to it, I think, as clinicians with societal preconceptions about what eating disorders look like. We expect to see someone who is very skinny or dramatically underweight, when in fact, only 6% of people who have eating disorders are clinically underweight. But the rapidity with which people are losing weight on GLP-1 agonists, the extent of weight loss, the restrictive behaviors that accompany that weight loss, and the malnutrition that can then result are all consistent with the cardinal signs of eating disorders, and then taken together with a fear of gaining weight or gaining weight back, and a real fear of becoming fat, and or activities that interfere with weight gain, in this case, the GLP-1 agonists themselves, really in totality and to get taken together, fulfill the requirements of an eating disorder. But we're not, as clinicians, able to see that if the body of a person who started as obese, now somebody presents with a normal BMI, our tendency has always been to reaffirm what they are doing as a positive thing. Keep doing what you're doing. It's great, the change that you're making, when in fact, underneath that, it can be very dangerous.
So, what steps can clinicians take to identify these cardinal signs and then to reduce the associated risks in patients who are taking GLP-1 receptor agonists?
I think there's quite a lot of things actually that we can do to safeguard vulnerable populations in the context of GLP-1 agonist drug use. These are a class of medications that have tremendous value at the individual and population levels across multiple indications. We already know that we're starting to see a turn in the tide of the obesity pandemic epidemic, and the benefits of that societally and at an individual level are substantial. But with respect to this small minority of people who have risk factors for eating disorders, it does make sense to start thinking about how we can safeguard vulnerable people. And there are some common sense things that we can do. First, there are validated instruments that are short and easy to administer that we can use to screen for current or historical EDs prior to prescribing the medications, and periodically throughout the treatment to assess for development of those worrisome signs and symptoms. We can, I think, systematically increase regulatory oversight of compounding pharmacies. And as long as online wellness platforms operate in a way that replace physician interaction, regulations could be put into place that require live video visits that are used for the consultation, and that verifiable medical records that include height and weight are included in that consultation. We, as an industry, as a drug development industry, should and can conduct post-marketing studies with ED-related endpoints explicitly incorporated into the protocols. And indeed, we have the opportunity to conduct rigorous, well-controlled studies to assess the potential benefit of GLP-1s in certain eating disorders, like binge eating disorder.
Finally, you say in your article that increased understanding of the biology of obesity may point us in new and surprising directions. So, how do you see this progress being leveraged to support new treatments for anorexia nervosa?
The science of anorexia nervosa in particular has evolved substantially over the last decade or so, driven by efforts to understand the underlying genetics of the disorder. And it's becoming clear that the genetic and biological basis of anorexia nervosa in particular is something that can be understood as being on a continuum and on the opposite end, quite frankly, of many obesity phenotypes and disorders, and with a lot of variability in between. Many of the pathways that are important in metabolism and in energy homeostasis are shared between both obesity and anorexia. And so you can imagine that that creates an opportunity to identify druggable targets, to change the way that calories are burned, to alter the underlying metabolism, and in so doing, allow for more rapid weight gain in the acute treatment phases of anorexia nervosa, which will then make easier some of the behavioral and cognitive symptoms that accompany the disorder to improve. And not at the risk of oversimplifying a very complex and heterogeneous disorder, there are ways to think about developing solutions, pharmacologic solutions that would improve treatment outcomes for people with anorexia nervosa.
Thank you, Dr. Banks.